says that, you know, the women who went and confronted Muawiyah. There is one version of it which says the women who said La to Muawiyah. But that was their attitude. And this, if you look at those stories, you will see most of them were from the Shi'i community of the time. One of them actually, when Muawiyah at the end listened to the whole story, he says, "What do you want?" And she says, "You know, these are the requests that I have, the list, what we want." And Muawiyah said, "I'll give you more than that. Will I be replaced with Ali in your heart then?" And she says, "No. You can give me whatever you want. And I'm sure if I had gone to Ali and asked for that, he would have said that no, because Ali would not give to anyone anything from Baytul Mal but that that person has the right for it. You are just giving it because you want to please people. And so that is the difference between you and Ali. So don't ask me that, you know, by giving me things, I'm going to replace, you know, Ali with you in my heart. No, that is still something we cannot negotiate on that issue." And so this is the sense of adl that we see at that time, which also manifests when we look at this Christian writer that I mentioned yesterday, that he gives this title, Sawtul Adalatil Insaniya to Ali, the voice of human justice. This is amazing that there are so many personalities in the history of Islam. You know, he is not even a Shi'i, he is a Christian. But when he studies, he sees that this title, that someone becoming the voice of human justice, does not apply to anyone but Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This week, we're looking at the recent pronouncements of the Canadian psychologist and conservative commentator Jordan Peterson. Peterson's known for his critical views on feminism, but he's now turned his attention to Muslims. In a controversial video, he's urged Muslims to, as he puts it, stop regarding Christians and Jews as your enemies. But is the reality of his appeal aimed at just normalising Zionism? I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. Before that, though, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation into the background to Peterson's comments.
The Canadian academic Jordan Peterson has raised the ire of Muslims around the world with his latest video.
In the aftermath of the extraordinary Abraham Accords, which have laid out the possibility for peace between all the people of the book in an unprecedented manner. And I have something to say as an extension of all of this.
He then proceeds to lecture Muslims on opening up to other groups of people. He even suggests that they must begin pen pal relationships with different sects, including Jewish people. The caption for the video states clearly what the motive behind the video is. In the aftermath of the Abraham Accords, Dr. Jordan B. Peterson suggests that the Muslim community can set a historical example by reaching across the aisle and making contact with whom they regard as the enemy. What about the media platform which produced the video with Peterson? The Daily Wire has recently signed him for a substantial figure. It is managed on a day-to-day basis by Chief Operating Officer John Lewis, who is a former intelligence analyst in the U.S. Marine Corps. It also employs former U.S. military intelligence officer Wesley Schmidt in customer service analytics. One of the founders of the Daily Wire is Ben Shapiro, a well-known pro-Israel YouTuber. Shapiro is a friend of the U.S. Special Envoy for Economic Normalization, Ariel Lightstone, and has hosted several interviews to promote the Abraham Accords, including with admitted liar Mike Pompeo. Ben Shapiro once tweeted that Israelis like to build, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. Prior to founding the Daily Wire, Shapiro was a Shulman Fellow at the controversial David Horowitz Freedom Center. His role was provided by Robert Shulman, a board member of the Friends of the IDF, who pumps millions into the building of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. The other founder of the Daily Wire, Jeremy Boring, was intimately involved in the Prager University project founded by Israel lobbyist Dennis Prager. The CEO of PragerU is Marissa Streit, formerly of the Military Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli occupation forces. The current senior editor and researcher at PragerU is Richard Lim, who was previously deputy associate director at the White House and then went on to be a program analyst at the FBI. The Daily Wire not only shared Jeremy Boring with the PragerU project, but also funders. Both organizations were financed by fracking billionaires, the Wilkes brothers. The Wilkes brothers provided the seed funding for the Daily Wire and regular financial support for the PragerU. Dan Wilkes Foundation also lavished financial support on Liberty Council, which has a Stand with Israel campaign, which consists of tours of the apartheid state and includes briefings by Israeli government, military, business and academic leaders. Both Shapiro and the PragerU project have also enjoyed funding from the Bradley Foundation, which has financed a panoply of Zionist organizations, including ones involved in illegal settlement building in the West Bank. So, we see that the media organization behind Jordan Peterson's normalization video has considerable links to not only US, but Israeli intelligence.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Batul Sabeti. Batul is an energy engineer, human rights activist, and political analyst based in London. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. Tell us about these Abraham Accords. I mean, you've previously pointed to military agreements between Israel and Morocco as far back as the 1960s. So what's new about these developments?
Well, the key thing that's new about them is the economic arrangements which go along with them, and in particular the attempt to economically integrate between Israel and some of the Middle Eastern countries, West Asian countries like the UAE, for example, the effectively Israeli and US client state, which is a dictatorship, as you'll know, and with the Saudis as well. I mean, there's a strong relationships with the Saudis being developed by the Israelis. I mean, people, I guess, are sometimes surprised when you say that. They say, well, surely the Saudis are very critical of the Israeli state. Well, no, actually, they are part of this process of normalization, and there's been a process like that in the House of Saud for some considerable time. So this is about economic integration, and it's about trying to embed the state of Israel in the economies of other West Asian countries.
Mm. And Batul, I mean, as somebody from the region, I mean, what's your thoughts about this effort to integrate the economies of the Arab states with the Zionist regime.
Right. It's important that we look at the Abraham Accords in the context of the balance of powers on the ground. So America is increasingly shrinking from the region. It's losing its strategic importance to it because all of their plans have been thwarted one after the other by the resistance movements on the ground that have only been gaining strength. So when we look at the Abraham Accords, we need to see it within the context of the deal of the century that was put forward that supposedly alluded that it wanted to find a solution to the Palestinian issue. That was not actually the case due to the fact that there was not a single Palestinian representative that was present, and even the PA, which was born out of Oslo, rejected this deal. That shows you the extent to which it was just unfathomable in terms of, you know, supposedly coming up with a solution. Rather, what the Abraham Accords was about, as was just mentioned over here, was forming a kind of united, coordinated front on the ground, an alliance that could actually confront the resistance axis that has been against American hegemony and that has been jeopardizing their interests. If we see with Biden's recent visit to the Middle East, there's been a lot of talk over kind of the void that is now emerging as America is withdrawing from the region. So right now, America's focus isn't so much on leveraging resources. I mean, it's milked the region and it hasn't gained much from that in the past two decades. Rather, its main focus is on not allowing Russia and China to strategically benefit from the region. Mm. So it's important that as it's leaving, it leaves behind a kind of united coalition and force that could serve its interests, as obviously now the battle with America is shifting from the Middle East elsewhere with Russia that is obviously threatening its the unipolar nature of American hegemony.
No, indeed. And when you refer to the PA, you're referring to the Palestinian
Authority. The Palestinian Authority, exactly.
Yeah, of course, yeah. David, just tell me, I mean, what do you make of this media company, the Daily Wire, that produced the Jordan Peterson video?
Well, it's a bit of a stunning investigation that's been done here. So all credit to the people who dug this up. So this is an organisation which you wouldn't necessarily have known about, and it's actually set up by this guy called Ben Shapiro, who has vile racist anti-Palestinian views. Its project is to support the Israeli foreign policy objectives, and normalization is a key part of that. So that we often think that media organizations, even right-wing media organizations, are something of a black box where you don't look into their politics. But it's very clear from the investigation that's been done here that this is a pushing Zionist interests, and Peterson appears on the face of it to be simply the latest face of Zionist normalization.
Mm. I mean, Batul, how do you think Muslims should respond to Jordan Peterson's message to them?
Right. So there's a very famous quote by a man called Ali ibn Abi Talib in which he says that there is a word of truth in which evil is intended by it. If we look at the Quran, there's a verse that says, O mankind, we created you of nations and tribes so that you may get to know one another. The best amongst you is the most pious. Meaning that Islam's default position over here is go out, build links, ties, form relationships, but it needs to be on the basis of upholding key principles and values. Now, if you look at the essence of the Abraham Accords, what is it trying to fixate? It's trying to fixate one of the biggest shames to have occurred, and that is the dispossession of the Palestinians through the world superpowers colliding to dispossess them to fulfill their interests. That is what is being normalized. Further onto that, they are using the title of Abraham. Now, Abraham is known as the father of all three Abrahamic faiths, right? And he is known to be actually one of the most revolutionary figures to actually walk this earth with his message of actually standing up and challenging the unjust status quo. So it's almost like a lie so big, such as normalizing the Zionist regime, requires a name so big, such as Abraham, in order to kind of put it under that kind of moral guise, to justify it and to play around with perceptions so that people's minds get distorted.
Sure, of course. I mean, just turning again, David, to the Daily Wire, I mean, you know, they've been employing people who previously worked for US military intelligence. Do you think that's an issue?
Well, yes. I mean, we've seen on this program time and time again organizations which appear to be neutral or apolitical or present themselves as such, who have all sorts of people who've previously been in intelligence organizations, quite often Israeli intelligence organizations, but also the US and indeed in the UK. I mean, this is an issue. I mean, these are people who have learned skills when they were intelligence officers, which they will go on to apply in their new posts. But it also raises the question about whether they still remain intelligence officers. I mean, one of the ways in which intelligence operates is that people are given cover positions in corporations while they still maintain an intelligence role. So we should raise those kinds of questions. Maybe it's the case these people have all retired, but equally they will remain and will retain links with their previous employers, whether that's Unit 820 in the state of Israel in the Zionist regime, or whether it's in the FBI or in the CIA. So these are, or the or military intelligence, indeed. So these are really serious concerns, which seems to affect a whole range of organisations throughout civil society, not just media organisations, but a whole range more.
Yes, and you know, Unit 8200, if you just want to just briefly explain what that is.
Unit 8200 is the signals intelligence unit of, yes, of the Zionist regime. So it's like GCHQ, sure, in the UK, or like the National Security Agency,
of course,
in the US. You know, yeah, the organisations with which, for example, Edward Snowden, yeah, sure, was associated.
The tool. I mean, do you think Jordan Peterson was just being mischievous when he was suggesting a pen pal system across sectarian lines, or do you think he was being genuine?
It's an interesting question of actually who is sowing the seeds of discord. If we look at even those who brokered the Abraham Accords, for example, America, right? Mm. It's these imperialist nations that actually seek to kind of weaponize and stoke the seeds of sectarianism, which are dormant within the hearts of average individuals, in order to serve their callous interests. Mm. Take, for example, the creation, the initiation and the funding of ISIS. You know, they considered ISIS to be this key strategic organization that could fight the line of resistance that had a kind of Shia characterization, if, yes, we're looking at that which is spearheaded by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So obviously ISIS fought the line of resistance under the sectarian notion, whereas if you look at how the resistance fought them, they fought them as part of the conspiracy of the American project for the region. Mm. So the point that I'm trying to allude to over here is that they are the ones that sow the seeds of these discords, yes, and they make a non-issue to be an issue. And then they come and say, you're uncivilized, mm, you know, you two need to come together to sort your house out, basically. Yes. And it's important that we also allude to the reality on the ground is that this is not an issue in the, yes, region. What is an issue is divide between the first world and the third world. The, yes, issue is a divide between the East and the West. Of, as course, the capitalists, they gain monopoly over land, wealth and resources whilst the people of this land are impoverished. These are the issues that we need, yeah, to be talking about. These are the solutions that we need to be finding.
Well, we just have to pause there for a second. And of course, you know, the ISIS example is not a unique one, is it? But we just want to now have a look at this report on the Abraham Global Peace Initiative.
Another interesting link in the Peterson chain to the Abraham Accords is his connection with Israel lobby group, the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, based in his home country of Canada. The organization, which claims involvement in Morocco normalizing relations with Israel, was established to, quote, give strength to the Abraham Accords. The board of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative features General Moshe Yaalon, former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, Minister of Strategic Affairs, and head of the Israeli military. It also includes Brigadier General Amir Avivi, former head of auditing for the Israeli military establishment, including the Israel Occupation Force and the Israeli military industries. Ralph Nurnberger was legislative liaison at the infamous Israeli lobby group AIPAC for many years and now graces the board of AGPI with his presence. Another Israeli military figure featured on the board of this normalization group is Colonel Kobi Marom, a former brigadier commander of the Israeli military during the failed occupation of South Lebanon. The former deputy chief of mission at the Israeli embassy, Dan Arbil, sits on the board too, alongside Yoel Hassan, a former president of the World Zionist Congress and personal counselor to Ariel Sharon. The British Israel lobby group, the Board of Deputies, even has a presence, with their vice president, Edwin Shuker, holding a position on the board of the AGPI. Flor Hassan Nahum, the mayor of Occupied Jerusalem and founder of the UAE Israel Business Council, is also present in this rogues gallery of board members. The Abraham Global Peace Initiative is also home to an assortment of current and former Canadian security personnel and the senior rabbi of the UAE, Dr. Eli Abadi. Peterson has consistently publicly supported the work of AGPI board member Richard Cravats. When Cravats accused members of the US Congress who oppose US military aid to the Israeli military of anti-Semitism, Peterson publicly supported this unoriginal Israeli lobby tactic and tweeted the sad excuse for an article by Cravats to his millions of followers. There are several very prominent supporters of Peterson within the AGPI. The founder, Avi Ben-Lolo, has written about the supposed campaign to silence the Canadian academic. Another board member, Mohamed Tahwidi, has heralded Peterson as, quote, one of the greatest, smartest and brightest scholars to ever contribute to human thought. He went on to tweet Peterson's message to Muslims with the hashtag Abraham Accords. It appears that Peterson has been enlisted as a cultural weapon in the war to integrate the economies of key Arab states with the Israeli one, a danger to all.
David, what do you make of the revelations in the film there about this Abraham Global Peace Initiative?
Well, I mean, we, over the last however many weeks we've been doing the show, every week we come across new Israel lobby groups we haven't heard of before, which are exposed as having covert or overt Zionist links. And here's another one, extraordinary. I mean, even in the process of researching this, we came across a further one which has got an almost identical name, which has got the Abraham Accords in its title and Peace Institute. And so there's a huge rash of these organisations set up to embed and further and lobby on the Abraham Accords. There are literally thousands of Zionist organisations all over the world. I mean, almost thousands in the UK itself, and certainly many thousands in the US. So it's a kind of whack-a-mole situation, isn't it, where we spot one organisation and then a few days later there's another one and another one. And this really shows the huge effort that goes into this. It's not just Israeli intelligence and money and Zionist foundations. It's a huge effort which is internally networked. Muslim apparent scholars, and of course his credentials for being a scholar are extremely minimal, as you will have seen if you've read anything about him. And to try and present this as being what Muslims should do. They should get in bed with the Zionists. They should pretend that the Palestinians haven't been dispossessed. They should pretend that there's not ongoing ethnic cleansing and indeed a slow genocide in Palestine, and pretend that we can all be nice to each other. And this is not the way to produce peace or justice.
I mean, and they often sort of adopt benign sounding and worthy names, don't they? But that's sort of part of the subterfuge, no doubt. But Tuul, isn't it interesting that this lobby group was seemingly established to strengthen the Abraham Accords? I mean, how did the resistance groups in the region respond to these machinations?
Right. The reality is that the resistance doesn't really get dragged to the squares that they want them to be dragged into.
No,
they have their own line, they have their own set of aims, and they have their own trajectory. And they respond to threats as they arise on the ground, and not political talks. Mm. It's actions on the ground that are threatening, whether it's economic, whether it's military, that they would respond to, and they will use the tools at their disposal for those objectives. But on a whole, the trajectory of the resistance is one of securing the interests for the people of the region. It's to ensure that the people of the region have their own independent voices and they can curate and craft their own destinies. Mm. So at the heart of this, we need to understand that this is why the resistance is actually being targeted, and actually the resistance is actually spearheading the real message of Abraham, which is one of dignity and freedom.
Indeed. I mean, David, the Global Peace Initiative works closely with the Canadian police and the security services there, doesn't it? It's a familiar tactic, isn't it? And it's been deployed by the Israel lobby in Britain. I mean, can you give us one or two examples of how they've kind of operated in Britain?
Well, I mean, the key examples in the US and in Britain are, in the case of Britain, the Community Security Trust, and in the case of the US, the Anti-Defamation League, which are kind of parallel organisations. So their main aim, they say, is to combat anti-Semitism, but of course they deliberately blur anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, and they regard anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism as being more or less coterminous. And they are deeply, deeply integrated with the police in this country and in the US with the FBI. Indeed, the ADL, back to the 1940s, even before the creation of the State of Israel, was collaborating with the FBI and informing on people to the FBI and trying to, they were spying on Arab American activists and trying to have them deported or locked up. And it's the same with the Community Security Trust here. They maintain huge files on Muslims, on people on the left, indeed on anti-Zionist Jews. You have huge files on some anti-Zionist Jews, which I've seen. And they use these to defame these people and to accuse them of being anti-Semitic, and they use them to pass on to the Home Office and indeed to the intelligence services. So there's a very strong relationship between the Zionist movement and the intelligence and police services in both this country and in the US and maybe other countries too.
Can you also say a word or two about the board members of the Abraham Global Peace Initiative, David?
Well, I mean, you see, a collection, a ragbag collection of, the film said, a rogues gallery. I mean, these are people who have very senior roles in the Zionist entity, and the Minister for Strategic Affairs, which, of course, was given the job in 2015 of being the main ministry to combat boycott, divestment and sanctions all around the world. Mm. People who've had all sorts of connections with the Israel occupation forces, and indeed with the direct repression of the Palestinians. So you can see the kind of character of it from those kinds of people. And the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, who is a proud settler, that's the trajectory, isn't it? They pretend that the occupation, which they call the occupation of the West Bank and the Golan, is just some kind of thing which we no longer pay attention to, and that really all the new settlements that they're building are just a process we can't stop. Well, of course, none of that's true. The occupation of the West Bank, indeed of the whole Palestine, could be reversed, and that's what we see in the future for the resistance.
Yeah. I mean, Batul, you've written, haven't you, about the reverse effects of bribe normalisation. I wonder if you could briefly tell us a little bit about your observations on that.
Sure. I think that the crux of the issue is that the Abraham Accords came up from a position of weakness and not strength. I mean, Israel was an entity that never dreamed of leaving South Lebanon in 2000 when it was forced to unilaterally withdraw, for example. In addition to 2005, when it unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, for example, we see that all the battles that it fought from 2008 to 12 to 14 to 21 have failed. And then consider also the embargoes, the sieges, the sanctions that have been on the resistance line as a whole, of course, because this is a coordinated resistance axis, right? So when all of those have failed, when the Western strategy for the region has failed, what do they resort to? They start to resort to kind of empty talks, sound bombs. And the open normalization of ties is an example of this, because it's not like the resistance has basically lost any allies, and it's not like Israel has gained any allies. Yeah. It's simply a question of relations going from being under the table to now being over the table. Yes, it might have in some respects facilitated the security, the military operations, the economic outputs and ties, but in terms of people's perceptions, if you now quiz in Egypt or Jordan, I think it was yesterday the Cradle Media released one of the polls which said that only 5% of the populations of those countries, in Egypt normalized ties back in the 80s under Anwar Sadat, and Jordan and Wadi Araba in the 1990s before Oslo, only 5%. So this shows that the hearts and the minds of the people, they know what the oppression is and the reality of it. So in many ways, this is revealing those who are walking the talk and those who are normalizing ties and lowering their heads in shame. And none of the American strategies for the region has worked. Certainly this one hasn't, and it's ultimately expired in a way, of the century.
Indeed. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Batul and to David, our resident expert. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Heat waves, droughts, floods, and storms push up the number of cases, make diseases more severe, and hamper people's ability to cope, says Mackenzie Prillman-Ryder in an article published under the heading, Climate Change is Making Hundreds of Diseases Much Worse. Stay tuned for more. Climate change has exacerbated more than 200 infectious diseases and dozens of non-transmissible conditions, such as poisonous snake bites, according to an analysis. Climate hazards bring people and disease-causing organisms closer together, leading to a rise in cases. Global warming can also make some conditions more severe and affect how well people fight off infections. Most studies on the associations between climate change and disease have focused on specific pathogens, transmission methods, or the effects of one type of extreme weather. Camilo Mora, a data scientist at the University of Hawaii at Mauna, and his colleagues scoured the literature for evidence of how 10 climate change-induced hazards, including surging temperatures, sea level rise, and droughts, have affected all documented infectious diseases. These include infections spread or triggered by bacteria, viruses, animals, fungi, and plants. The study was published in Nature Climate Change on August 8. Looking at basically all the climate effects and all the infectious pathogens in one paper is extremely ambitious, says Josh Colston, an epidemiologist at the University of Virginia School of Medicine in Charlottesville, adding, they synthesize a tremendous amount of information very well. The study quantifies the many ways in which climate change affects human diseases, says Mora, adding, we are going to be under the constant umbrella of this serious threat for the rest of our life. Mora and his colleagues examined more than 77,000 research papers, reports, and books for records of infectious diseases influenced by climatic hazards that had been made worse by greenhouse gas emissions. More than 90% of the relevant papers had been published after 2000. Ultimately, the team found 830 publications containing 3,213 case examples. The researchers discovered that climate change has aggravated 218, or 58%, of the 375 infectious diseases listed in the Global Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology Network, GIDEON, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Notifiable Diseases Surveillance System. The total rises to 277 when including non-transmissible conditions such as asthma and poisonous snake or insect bites. The team also identified 9 diseases that are diminished by climate change. Many studies examine transmissible diseases because the conditions can transfer between people and are therefore feared the most, says Mora. But as he and his colleagues gathered more data, they found reports of worsening non-communicable diseases such as asthma outbreaks caused by increased level of plant and fungal allergens because of global warming. Those allergens are still pathogens, biological agents that cause harm to the human body, says Mora, adding, but nobody is paying attention to them. The team also identified 1,600 ways in which climatic hazards have led to cases of disease. Many of those involved bringing pathogens and people closer together. Increases in temperature and rainfall, for example, have expanded the range of mosquitoes and contributed to outbreaks of dengue fever and malaria. At the same time, heat waves draw more people to water-related activities, leading to a rise in cases of waterborne illnesses, such as gastroenteritis. Storms, sea level rise, and floods force people to move and have been implicated in outbreaks of Lassa fever, cholera, and typhoid fever. Climate threats have also made some pathogens more virulent or boosted their transmission. For example, high temperatures increase the survival and biting rates of mosquitoes carrying West Nile virus. Furthermore, these hazards weaken people's ability to cope with infections through factors such as mental stress, lowered immunity, and malnutrition. It's incredible to have this evidence base that they have put together, says Colin Carlson, a global change biologist at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., but he notes there are even more diseases known to be influenced by climate change, and the effects of climate change on diseases are even broader than the study reveals. For instance, changing environmental conditions are harming healthcare access, food security, and other health outcomes, which are beyond the scope of the paper. He says there is no part of global health and climate change isn't reshaping.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for this holy month, the month of Muharram actually, and the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. Well, we're going to talk about some of the laws related to Muharram according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speakers. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the mourning laws or the mourning ceremonies laws about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question. You know, is it permissible to jog and utter the names of the infallibles successively and quickly in the mourning ceremonies?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, jogging is sometimes, it's a term that is usually referred to harwala. That's the word, the proper word used in Arabic language.
Mm-hmm.
So the practice of harwala is permissible. No religious authority has, because harwala means running quickly and briskly. So it is permissible, and there's no objection to someone walking briskly and jogging and uttering the names of the pure imams and the infallible imams successively and quickly. There's no objection. And of course, I as far as I know, this is a very common practice in Iraq. And when you go to the holy city of Karbala, you find Iraqis rushing to the holy shrine of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam and Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salatu wasalam, walking briskly and jogging. And of course, it's a common practice. There's no problem in it. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that as long as it does not lead to a bad image, there is no objection in it.
Mm-hmm, I see. The other question that is somehow, prevalent to some degree, in fact, you might hear uncommon expressions in such ceremonies,
sure.
All right, in the mourning ceremonies, not to mention maybe some of them are improper, basically.
Yes.
All right. Is there any, technical problem or jurisprudential problem with, the use of such expressions such as "I am Hussein's dog," for example, in such commemorative ceremonies?
Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, says that it's not advisable to utter such expressions. And the believers had better observe the standards of commemorating the martyrdom of the infallibles, especially Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So using such expressions is a kind of degrading. It's no religious authority has advised this, and it's better and advisable, according to His Eminence, to avoid such expressions.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and what is the ruling, what is the Islamic law about using musical instruments? Sometimes you would see that in the commemorative marches, they use such instruments as organs.
Yes. Well, using musical instruments is inappropriate, and it's befitting for mu'mineen, for Muslims, to avoid using such instruments in the commemoration ceremonies in the majalis of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam. And it's preferable to hold communication, ceremonies and commemoration ceremonies in the traditional way, which does not involve any kind of music. You know, there is one thing we should note, and that is musical instruments can be misused in different ways. If it is allowed by one religious authority or by the religious authorities, then there is no limit, there is no bound as to how these instruments be used and what kind of music should be played, of course, because there are different kinds of music, and of course it will become a license at the end of the day for some people to exploit and to use this kind of permission, this permission to play any kind of music. Mm-hmm. Some music, maybe some types of music are quite clearly offensive. They are licentious, they are frivolous, and therefore in order to prevent such things, the religious authorities consider playing music as something inappropriate.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you for listening to the program. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you, who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces, who are you?
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. It's Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still in the program as our guest speaker. We are still talking about the jurisprudential rules of the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein in the month of Muharram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, as a result of taking part in the commemorative ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, a worshipper missed out on some of the devotions, some of the rituals that he or she had to do, such as the morning prayer, for example. Isn't it better, do you think, for this worshipper to avoid going to such commemorative gatherings or ceremonies, you know, or breaking the habit that would result in alienation from the household of the Prophet?
Well, brothers and sisters, I just want to say that there is no doubt whatsoever that the obligatory prayers take precedence over the participation in the mourning ceremonies, in the majalis and the azadari, because we know for sure that the salat, the prayer, is the most important act of
the
worship.
Pillar of the religion.
It's the pillar of religion. And it is something which serves as the basis, and every other thing is based on this pillar. And if this pillar breaks, Mm-hmm. And if there is no such pillar, the whole construction, the whole building will collapse, and there will it will cease to exist, in fact. So therefore, we should not miss our prayers under any circumstance, no matter what the situation. And as mentioned by His Eminence, the obligatory prayer, and also as is stated clearly in the riwayat, in the mm-hmm. traditions and the hadith, of course, the obligatory prayer takes precedence over any other act, and including the participation in the majalis, in the gatherings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, and the gatherings which are meant to commemorate the event of Ashura and the martyrdom of the infallibles. So it is not permissible to overlook an obligatory act under the pretext of taking part in the majalis and gatherings such as the morning ceremony held for Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
I see.
And that is very important. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, we see that some men and women, they take part in the events of Ashura and they remain awake until late at night, for example, 3 o'clock. And in the morning, it's absolutely difficult for yes. such people to wake up. And therefore, there should be an arrangement for offering the morning, the Fajr prayer.
Yes.
People, in order for them not to miss the prayer, they should use their mobile phone or an alarm clock to wake up
yes.
for the prayer. Because if you miss your prayer, you have lost a great, you have missed a great reward.
Exactly. And a very quick question here, I may squeeze in at the end of this episode. Sheikh, during the month of the Muharram, as we all know, the commemorative processions and the sounds of drums and trumpets sometimes continue until after midnight. What is your view on such a practice?
Well, staging processions, taking to the streets to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam and his companions, and also taking part in these religious ceremonies is a good practice. It is a good act. It is a good work. It is commendable, and there's no objection in it. And of course, it is among the best deeds by which one can seek closeness to Allah. It is a means of proximity to God.
I see.
But one must be mindful not to embark on any action which might cause distress, which might cause disturbance, mm-hmm. or which may cause a headache to other people. Otherwise, it's going to be haram.
Okay.
And one should not do a recommended act which leads to a haram act. Mm-hmm.
I see. That's a very important
disturbing
thing.
Others and creating headache, bothering others is not
thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws, and until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave. Mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein plan to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.